So then, if you want to keep your tax rates the same after you've paid off debt, you have to have a Tabor election. Is that the idea?
Either that or sell all the snowplows and go out and buy, or have the lifetime of the snowplows over, go out and buy another fleet, but then you still have to have a Tabor election
right. To
buy the second fleet.
Okay. All right. I think I understand.
I'm not sure I do. To belabor the point a little bit, then let's go back to the parking garage example. Government decides to build a parking garage next to an office building, state office building or government office building. For 10 years, it charges people to park there to pay off the bonds, and at the end of 10 years, the parking garage is paid off with the revenue from parking. So the government agency might choose then to no longer charge for parking. But it seems like, if I read the language correctly, whether or not they charge for parking after 10 years, tax rates must be reduced by the annual amount of that parking revenue. Is that correct?
Well, if the parking garage was built, shall we say, with no charge for the user.
I'm talking about whether it was built solely by charges to the user. Parking fees paid off the cost of building the parking garage. No taxes were used at all. Revenue bonds only.
Okay. So now we have a parking garage that's fully paid for. It still has a potential revenue stream. This essentially is a tax.
To charge people to park there?
Yeah, to use people to park there. And this then should be either approved or disapproved by the voter.
So assuming they don't want to charge people to park there and they choose not to, say now it's free to the citizens to park at this government garage, it still seems like the language requires a reduction in tax rates.
Well, if the garage in its first 10 years or whatever the time period is entirely supported by charges to the user, then the tax, then the government really is in a wash situation, is it not? It hasn't gained any revenue from this project. It hasn't put any money into it. So why should there even be a tax reduction to reflect something that never had a tax in the first place?
The language seems to require a tax reduction, the way I read it. It says that current tax rates shall decline even if not repaid by taxes. And that's the scenario that I'm talking about.
Okay, but it doesn't say that the structure had, whether the structure was built with the obligation that it be paid by taxes, in which case the taxes should go away, or it was built with revenues from the user, in which case there never was a tax on the general populace.
I'm a little lost. In my hypothetical, no taxes were used whatsoever, but the language seems to say tax rates have to be reduced.
No comment. Any?
Ms. Northrup, if you do need to come to the microphone because we're being taped and broadcast. If you'll identify yourself and who you represent, please.
Michelle Northrup, I'm a citizen, and this only applies to borrowing.
You're also one of the proponents of the measure.
Yes, I'm okay. Proponent. This applies only to borrowing. So once the borrowing has been repaid, the taxes will go down accordingly to that repayment, and anything that happens after that time doesn't fall under here. And also, if you're talking about a parking garage that's been set up for the purposes of revenue, that kind of falls under enterprise, I believe. And so if the revenues are designed to pay off that loan, not taxes, then we're not being taxed. We're simply approving a loan, and the revenues are supposed to repay that. The only thing that would have to be repaid to the taxpayer are the taxes that he paid in order to float that loan. So this does not apply to anything that doesn't fall under monies borrowed from the people, which is what these are. So if a political subdivision of the state or the state says we are going to borrow money, the voters have approved it, there's a tax levied to repay that loan, we have our taxes reduced accordingly, even if that loan is repaid by the fees from the parking garage. So the parking garage is actually, I think, an excellent analogy example to use, because there may be a tax levied to repay that loan because fees from the parking garage are unknown. Are the fees going to be adequate to repay that loan appropriately? If they are not, then there will likely be a tax levied in order to repay that loan, with the idea that perhaps that parking garage might generate revenue for that subdivision later on. The idea is, if the parking garage is full all the time and it brings in appropriate revenue, then our taxes are not required to repay it back. What this says is, even if the loan is not repaid by taxes, if the loan is repaid by the fees taken from the parking garage, we still have to have our taxes reduced accordingly. The issue that this addresses is that we are continually taxed, even if a loan is repaid by other means. We are taxed as if that loan was never repaid. There's nothing to create a balance there whereby we're only paying for the loan. We end up paying for more than the loan because we're paying the loan as if fees were not generated to repay those. So they're two separate things. In terms of reducing taxes after the loan is repaid, let's say that the fees completely covered that loan and no taxes were required. Well, we should get that those funds, those taxes should be reduced accordingly. But once that obligation is met, it's met. You don't then have to reduce taxes to cover the revenue. That's something else altogether. That's not relationship to the loan. Any revenues gained after the loan is repaid, those aren't related to this at all.
I'm sorry if I'm being dense. The situation that I'm trying to describe does not involve any taxes at all. No taxes were imposed. They're simply revenue bonds. Bonds
are. If
there's
no tax imposed, then there's no change. There's nothing. Because this only applies if there is a voter approved revenue change. Change means up or down. So if we approve to have our taxes raised in order to pay for something, then once that's paid, those taxes should go down accordingly. If our taxes didn't change because the revenues covered that entirely, there was no tax. We approved the borrowing, but the fees from the parking garage paid it. There was no tax levied. Then there is no change to deal with. There's nothing. What this means is if I have been taxed to pay for something, once that is paid, my tax should be reduced accordingly.
I understand the principle. I just don't see that where the language supports that. It looks to me like whether or not taxes were used to build the parking garage, whether or not taxes were used for that purpose, taxes have to be reduced after the parking garage is paid off with parking revenue.
I don't see how it says that.
It seems to apply to all borrowing, not just borrowing that involves tax.
All current borrowing shall be paid, except enterprise borrowing, after each borrowing is fully repaid. Current tax rates shall decline as voter-approved revenue changes equal to its planned average annual repayment. If there was no revenue change on the voter's end, there's nothing to change. Change means up or down, so if there was no change, there's nothing to deal with. This refers to if I'm being taxed, so if the revenue change goes up, then, once that revenue is no longer required, it should go back down to its original place. So if current tax rate shall decline as voter-approved revenue changes equal to its planned average annual repayment, even if not repaid by taxes. If there was no change, then there's no...
You're saying this sentence only applies where there was a tax rate change.
If I'm not
where taxes
paying,
were imposed to pay off this borrowing.
In terms of changing the tax rate, yes. Not in terms of the borrowing. The borrowing still must be repaid. All that other stuff applies. But if my voter if there was no change, then there's nothing to change. I guess maybe I'm the one being dense. I don't understand why that. I'm not sure where this says that current tax rates shall decline, whether or not we were levied taxes or not. It doesn't say that. It says as voter approved revenue changes. That means if there was a change. If there was no change, then there's no tax rate to reduce because you didn't raise them. Reduce it if you raised it.
Ms. Eubanks.
Well, I do believe under Tabor you can have voter-approved revenue changes that don't involve taxes.
Right. It's a voter-approved revenue change, but if that revenue came from the parking garage and not from me, there's nothing to reduce.
Well, but it doesn't. It just says it doesn't even say that the. It just says current tax rates. It doesn't say the taxes that were imposed to pay for the borrowing shall be reduced. I mean, I think Mr. Hobbs and I have the same confusion because, one, it isn't limited to borrowing that's financed by tax increases, and it doesn't say that it's the tax rate imposed to finance the borrowing that then is now reduced, especially when you have this language at the end which says even if not repaid by taxes, which, understanding your explanation that they've gotten revenue from a different source, but I think you can also read that language to say that it could be because the borrowing is being repaid from something other than taxes, such as parking fees, and therefore it falls under this language.
You're correct about the fees in terms of other paying, but if the parking garage then continues to gain revenue, my tax rate should decline. Revenue has changed. My tax rate should go down. If the government is getting revenue out of that parking garage after the loan's been repaid, my taxes should go down accordingly. Because now the parking garage is generating revenue.
Even though it's fee revenue, not tax revenue.
That's still a revenue change.
And even though those fees may be going someplace that can't be used for funding general government operations. Okay. And just one other issue that's come up during this discussion, and understanding the concept, what you're trying to get at, in terms of these revenues continuing to be collected and then being used for other purposes.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be covered by your language change up in proposed section 6.1, which says that the use of funds can't be changed, so that they can only be used as specified in the ballot? So, for example, if you had a ballot title, you know, borrowing that's being funded by a revenue stream and it can only be used to pay off that borrowing, doesn't this language already deal with the problem you say you're trying to get at through the language in III?
It does to a degree, but not entirely. Do you have something to make sure about that?
Okay, so section 6, parenthesis 1, applies to borrowing by the state and borrowing by local governments. Again, as Michelle has said, we're talking only borrowing. Number 3 section down here, no borrowing may continue past its original term, I think is a very telling sentence in this thing. Because the question is, what the questions that are coming are, what happens after it's paid off?
If a parking garage, I like that analogy, sorry. If a parking garage, it works. A parking garage, I'm gone to as the voter. Do we want to purchase this parking garage? We need this bonded debt. Your taxes are going to be raised accordingly, but the fees will probably pay this off. Sounds good to me. And we're going to have fees generated afterwards, which will be used for a certain purpose. The ballot title shall specify the use of the funds, which shall not be changed. If the purpose of those additional revenues after the loan has been repaid off were to be sent to, were to be used for roads and bridges, subdivision cannot say, well, we're going to use it for something else. In that battle, once they tell us what those are to be used for, that's what 6.1 is referring to. When it says, which shall not be changed. So I think I'm having a hard time understanding where the confusion is over whether or not the tax rates decline if no tax is levied. And it depends on the revenue generated by the parking garage. If it's a non-revenue generating thing such as a snowplow, of course I'm going to be taxed. Once that loan is paid, my taxes should reduce accordingly. If it is a revenue generating enterprise, same thing applies. My taxes should be reduced accordingly, even if the revenue's paid off that loan, not my taxes. It's to prevent the taxpayer from being continually charged for principal and interest on a loan which has already been repaid. This is a sideways way for governments to increase their revenue stream. Where I'm asked if I want to pay for this thing, and I say yes, and then after it's paid, I'm still being charged to pay for something else. This is what these are specifically designed to prevent.
Okay, and if I could follow up on just something that you were in your explanation now about the ballot title specifying the use of the funds, and let's use the example of the parking garage. That the fees generated from the parking garage, the ballot title says it's to be used to pay off the monies borrowed to finance the garage. And once it's paid off, then the fees are going to be used for libraries. Are you saying that that's what has to be in that ballot title? I mean, regardless of whether the use is related to the borrowing or not.
They just need to tell us what those funds are for. That's what it comes down to. Now, with a parking garage that's charging fees, which is planned to, they're not going to give it away for free afterwards, they're going to continue to charge. That's sort of an enterprise. I think it really depends on what those funds are going to be used for. So it's hard to judge whether or not that's appropriate. You say libraries. I mean, they need to tell us what those funds are going to be used for. The reason I say that it gets a little sticky is because now you're talking about an enterprise. That's a business.
But your measure makes those enterprises, those businesses, get voter approval for borrowing, which is not current law.
Except enterprise borrowing.
Well, when you look in paragraph 2I, it says local districts, enterprises, authorities. So,
right.
So
okay.
Enterprises right now,
okay.
I mean, part of the concept of Tabor and being an enterprise is you're not subject to any of the requirements of Tabor. This would change that by requiring even enterprises to get approval for borrowing or debt. Correct?
Yes. If it's an enterprise from a political subdivision of a state, yes. I think what I mean by enterprise in terms of future revenues is that if the parking garage is getting increased revenue from that garage, from fees paid to that garage, my taxes should go down accordingly because now the government now has a new revenue stream. So the loan's gone. The loan's repaid. And my taxes went down accordingly to that loan. It should continue to go down. If the government has another revenue stream coming in that's paying off that loan and also paying this, my taxes should go down accordingly unless I've approved for the state to have additional, for the subdivision, the authority, whatever it is, to have that additional income.
Thank you.
I don't know if I'm explaining myself very well.
No, I think I understand your concept. I think for me it's just a question of whether your language actually takes your concept and includes it in the
May I address some of your other questions, though?
Sure.
But, one was the use of the term authority. I thought Russ explained that really well. The purpose of using the word authority is that this is one of the constructs that is created to get a certificate of participation and sort of say we're not this type of government. We're not really getting a loan. So that's the use of the word authority. So while they are two different things, there's a different thing. There's a difference between the state and a political subdivision of the state. So I think you're correct on defining those two, but they are both included. Authorities, either divisions of the state or political subdivisions of the state. An authority such as a transportation authority does fall under this. The other one was the reference to any loan, whether or not it lasts more than 1 year or may default. That is specifically to address a weakness in Tabor. And we have instances where things are not being called multi-year loans because the option to default is actually considered. Well, we can always default, and we'll reconsider it year to year whether or not we're going to default. The people's credit rating is not protected in that. We don't like the idea of governments assuming that they can ruin the public's credit as a matter of course. That's not appropriate. So that's what that addresses.
But is it actually a default when the terms of the borrowing is that it's conditional on annual appropriation? That to me, that default means you're obligated to pay and you don't, versus a contract saying that you're not obligated to pay unless you choose
we're talking about default. Actual default. We're talking about,
because, for example, certificates of participation, which are based on annual appropriation, is not a default. It's just,
but it's still a loan.
But that isn't viewed as a default. I don't believe that if a government chose not to continue making payments on a COP that's conditional on an annual appropriation, that would affect credit rating.
If it's not a default, then it's not a default. If it is a default, then it is a default.
Okay.
If they are two different things, then that's fine. This should cover all of those circumstances.
Thank you.
And then nope, that's it.
Okay.
Thank
Great.
You.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the proponents? If not, then let's turn to jurisdiction. Any discussion concerning single subject? Anybody who wishes to testify on the subject of single subject? Discussion by the board? Ms. Eubanks?
Based on our conversation just now, primarily focused on paragraph 3I, I have concerns that the measure constitutes a single subject. Although I understand the proponent's intent and what they're trying to achieve by the third sentence in III, I'm not sure that it has the effect that they intend. And because, to me, it's not tied to borrowing that's financed by taxes, and I think even the proponents in their later comments said it shouldn't matter whether the borrowing is financed by fees or taxes, that there's those revenues after the fact, that taxes should go down. And what that reminds me of is other measures that the Supreme Court has held not to constitute a single subject, based on the fact that it requires a reduction in government spending, and that since a lot of what this measure is doing is dealing with borrowing, indebtedness, debt, whatever you want to call it, to me, in terms of requiring tax rates to be reduced as voter-approved revenue changes, which is relevant for purposes of fiscal year spending limits contained in subsection 7 of Tabor. To me, what that does is forces a reduction in spending limits, regardless of whether the borrowing is funded by taxes or not. And so that's one single subject concern I have. The other is in terms of the proposed change up in 6.1 about specifying the ballot title. There are already ballot title requirements in Tabor. This would add to it. Usually things like ballot titles are viewed as procedural rather than, I would view them differently than sort of the core issue of requiring voter approval or how the limitations that are set forth in the 4C provisions. And so I'm also concerned that that may constitute a single subject, and especially if the ballot title has to include the use of funds which aren't related to the borrowing, such as when the borrowing is repaid. It could be to fund libraries, trails, who knows what. Again, that seems to perhaps go outside the single subject about indebtedness, and I don't see that those changes dealing with voter approved revenue changes and the ballot title necessarily are connected or dependent on the general focus of the measure on limiting or restricting indebtedness by the state or local governments.
You know, I think I agree with a lot of what you said, Ms. Eubanks, but I might take a run at arguing the other side first. In the last paragraph, I agree that as best I can tell from the discussion, I don't think the proponent's language says what they think it says. I mean, I do think it says that if you don't use tax money, you issue revenue bonds, you repay it within 10 years with parking receipts, no taxes involved, then tax rates have to come down, whether or not you continue to charge parking. The question is that forced reduction in tax rates, is that a separate subject? And I think there is maybe case law that suggests that it might be. My attempt to find a single subject is that the staff draft stab at describing a single subject is restriction of government bonding. And it seems to me, in the going back to the parking garage situation, that's borrowing. And if I were an enterprise or a government agency, I wouldn't do that. Because even though I've got a financing analysis that says I can pay it off with parking receipts, the tax rates are going to have to go down. Arguably, that's a restriction on government bonding, a borrowing. I wouldn't issue revenue bonds in that situation. And whether or not that's the proponent's intent, I think that would certainly discourage issuing revenue bonds in an enterprise situation. And maybe I'm wrong about that, but let me just go on to the other one as well. And I'm not so sure. I hadn't really thought that one through, so I'm even more at risk of being wrong about that. But it seems like we're still dealing with borrowing in 6.1 and requiring that in borrowing the ballot titles have to specify the use of the funds. Maybe that's still restriction of government bonding, but I may have misunderstood your argument on that one as well, Ms. Eubanks. You maybe.
Well, in terms of that argument, just because the nature of that requirement is more procedural than, to me, substantive in terms of local governments can only do this type of borrowing under these conditions. That seems to be adding to current requirements in Tabor regarding what has to be in a ballot title for bonded debt or borrowing. And especially if now the ballot title is dealing with not only borrowing, but then the use of the funds after the borrowing is repaid.
It's not dealing with it. You asked me a question about that, and I responded to what I thought about it, but that's not addressed by this at all. It's only addressing the borrowing. It's not addressing additional revenue streams.
But the continuation, for example, the parking garage, the fees, once the fees are used to pay off the borrowing, and perhaps I misunderstood, but I thought you said that if those fees continue to be imposed for parking, that they can be used for such uses as would be specified in the ballot title.
Yeah, that has to do with how they intend to use additional funds. I'm talking specifically about the loan repayment and how taxes should be reduced according to how that borrowing goes down incrementally over that time. So the taxes are reduced accordingly. Even if the loan is paid off with fees ahead of time, my taxes go down accordingly as if it was being paid by my taxes. So if you're talking about funding after that loan is repaid and after the tax has been, such as additional revenues from a parking garage, that has nothing to do with this.
Okay.
I mean, what,
and then
what,
I misunderstood.
What is used by how the government entity chooses to use additional fees from that garage after the loan has been repaid and after my taxes have been reduced according to that loan, that's a separate issue altogether. It has nothing to do with this particular ballot type.
All right. Thank you.
I was worried I wasn't speaking. I was like, wait, this has nothing to do with this. So
I'm sorry. Is the point of that in 6.1 then that you'll get a ballot that you would get a ballot that would say this political subdivision proposes to issue bonds in the amount of $1 million and it will use that $1 million for X, the money that comes in immediately from selling the bonds? That's what you have to specify in the ballot title. Not that you have to specify we will repay those bonds either through taxes or through fees on a parking garage. That doesn't necessarily have to be specified in that ballot title, right? It's what you do with the immediate income from the sale of the bonds.
Title says you will build a garage with this repayment schedule.
Right. So we're selling these bonds, and therefore we expect to get $1 million selling these bonds. That $1 million will be used for X, and it can only be used for X. Because what we were talking about before was not that initial influx of money from the sale of the bonds. It was trying to specify what you're going to do with either increase taxes or fees in the case of the parking garage. So that's not that makes more sense to me, I think, in terms of both the language and conceptually. It's easier to do, to say we're selling bonds, we're going to use the money from the bonds for X, and that's all it has to say. Okay.
Ms. Eubanks.
And if I could respond to your first comment about the language in III, while I agree that the vast majority of this measure would fall under a single subject such as restriction of government borrowing as appears in the staff draft, I don't think that this sentence is dealing with borrowing. It's after the borrowing is fully repaid. It's dealing with taxes. It's not even...
Hold on.
The language doesn't even specify that it's taxes have been imposed to pay off the borrowing. It just says, you know, tax rate shall decline, and then you have, to me at least, this troubling language, even if the borrowing hasn't been repaid by taxes. And so to me that sentence is dealing with something that affects spending. It's reducing their fiscal year spending limits by being voter-approved revenue changes and decreasing their tax rates to reduce their revenue, which to me means they aren't going to have as much revenue to spend, because this isn't necessarily the taxes that are being imposed for the borrowing. It could be sales taxes, it could be property taxes, and that's why I because of the confusion on this language, I'm concerned that it wouldn't fit in that subject.
I see where your confusion is, and I see why you could interpret it that way, but that's not what it says. This applies only to the loan voter-approved revenue changes equal to planned average annual repayment. This is essentially a good faith clause, which says, if you repay the loan with all your parking garage fees, you reduce my taxes for that loan according to the average annual repayment. So even if you repay that loan, you're going to reduce my taxes according to how it would have been paid. So in a sense, if you pay it off early as a government, you're still getting a little bit over because we're keeping our agreement in terms of my taxes for this purpose shall be reduced accordingly. Back down to, so it's just affecting that loan. There's nothing in here that says that it would apply to any other revenue stream, which should be separate. Here it says, such declines do not replace others required future current tax rate shall decline as voter-approved revenue changes equal to the planned average annual repayment, even if not repaid by taxes. This applies to that specific loan. It doesn't apply to some other loan. It doesn't apply to some other revenue stream. It applies to the loan that we're talking about right here. So whichever loan we're talking about, the tax rate shall decline accordingly as that loan is repaid and according to that agreement. Such declines do not replace others required. Now, what this means is that you can't use one reduction to cover three loans. It applies to the specific loan involved. So if we make an agreement, we're going to take out this loan, your taxes are going to go up this much. As this loan is repaid, your taxes will go down this much, back to where they started before this loan was apart. If you repay it off here, my taxes decline at the same rate. It's the same. We made an agreement. If you choose to repay that loan early, my taxes should still decline accordingly. And it applies to that loan. There's nothing here that says tax rates for other revenue streams shall decline accordingly. It says tax rates shall decline as voter-approved revenue changes equal to its planned average annual repayment. That's referring to the loan in question, not to any other revenue stream.
Are you trying to say that the voter-approved revenue change language is how you calculate how much the taxes will go down total? So if you approved a increased revenue change, if there was a voter-approved increase in revenue of $1 million, and then once it's repaid, you go back down $1 million? Because I have to say, I'm not troubled by it as a matter of single subject, but I agree with Ms. Eubank's interpretation of the language, which is, if you use debt to pay for something, once you've paid it back, however you paid it back, fees, taxes, whatever, you have to reduce taxes once it's paid back by the amount of your average annual repayment. I mean, that's what it says. The only language in there that's a little bit confusing is as voter-approved revenue changes. And so I'm wondering what your interpretation of that language is. Because Ms. Eubanks is right, you can have voter-approved revenue changes, and in fact you would for taking out debt if you're up against your revenue limit, even if you're not increasing taxes to pay it.
I haven't increased my taxes. I have to then reduce them.
Well, I don't understand where you get that out of this language. That's, you can borrow money without increasing taxes. The government can. This says, after each borrowing is fully repaid, current tax rates shall decline as voter-approved revenue changes equal to the average annual repayment, even if not repaid by taxes.
So,
to me, now maybe the way you get around that is all those cases you set up an enterprise, and so the parking garage would have its own little, the city would create an enterprise, and then that sentence doesn't apply. But I read that the same way I think you two do, that no matter how you pay it back, once it's paid back, you have to cut revenue, cut taxes somewhere else, even if it wasn't taxes. Now, to me, that's not troubling as a single subject matter, because it's only triggered by if you add some government, if you're growing government through the use of debt, that is the only way that comes into play. And so my original question, I think, way back when, got at that, which is my interpretation of that, is that if you want to build a parking garage, that's fine. And if you want to keep using the revenue from that, that's fine. But then you got to cut something else, which if you use debt to pay for it. And to me, that's very closely tied to debt. It doesn't apply. The proponents are definitely correct that that doesn't apply outside the context of government borrowing, and it is, I think, an interesting additional step, but not a separate subject. I mean, relative to things that we've approved that go the other direction, where we allow you to increase a specific tax or two and then specify a completely unrelated list of government programs to which you want to apply those increased funds, this is much more tightly tied together than I think a lot of what we've approved.
Well, it does strike me that it's still about borrowing. I'm still a little concerned about the cases that talk about reductions in government spending, but it seems like this is maybe different, and that's kind of where I am, I guess, at this point. So we do need to move on.
Right.
And I think then for number 18, and we maybe we'll sort of take a fork in the road here and work on number 18. We've been really talking about 18 and 21, I think, but I'll go ahead and make a motion that for number 18, the board find that the measure comprises a single subject and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Then let's start with the staff-prepared draft, which Ms. Gomez will display on the screen in the room. And I'll first turn to proponents and ask them if they've had a chance to look at the staff draft and if they have any comments. Now, I think, I don't know whether it really, there's something at my place. I'm not sure whose this is, but maybe if you'd like to talk about that, what that is, and the staff draft. I'm inferring that you don't like the staff draft, and you somebody likes this.
Yes.
Okay.
A wonderful story that came out of World War II. A submarine commander sent a message back to base regarding his actions. He said, in four words, what he did: sighted ship, sank, same. We have an alternate version here, which we think says the same thing the staff draft does in 62 words. We do not think that there is as much, or there is much reason for having all the what we consider to be extraneous words in the staff draft. I think we say basically the same thing.
And I haven't read it before, so I'm just pausing to finish reading the proponent's suggested title. Mr. Schroeder, you are also signed up. Did you want to testify on the titles? Sure, if that's all right, let's go ahead and hear from Mr. Schroeder. If you'll identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
For the record, I am Lou Schroeder, and I represent myself here. I just want to make a short plea that I think you've heard from me several times before, and I strongly feel KISS principle needs to be applied here, and it doesn't make it better to use all the good language you guys learned in law school. And I think that we should point towards making it as simple, easy as possible for Joe voter when he or she gets behind the curtain in the voting booth. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Let me just ask proponents. My initial reaction to your alternative draft, I have some concerns about. But the first part of it, we have to clearly express the single subject, and we can maybe reformat it. But I think you're essentially agreeing with the staff draft, maybe that the single subject is limiting government borrowing. But the next clause says, which repeals, enacts, and shortens certain government debt provisions. And I'm not sure what that means to a reader, repeals, enacts, and shortens certain government debt provisions. I'm not sure that tells anybody anything, except that it does something about debt. And, pardon me?
It tells me something.
What does that mean?
It means repeals, enacts. It means you're talking about the law, and shortens. It means you're talking about shortening a law. So this obviously is referring to the Constitution of the State of Colorado. That's what you're changing. Repeals and enacts. That's what repeal and enact mean. It's referring to a law to shorten certain government debt provisions. What certain government debt provisions tells me is that I'm going to look this up. In other words, not enough room here to explain the whole thing to me. It's a title. It's a subject heading. So it's, I don't find anything.
Well, I mean, my point was, it doesn't say how the law is changing. It says the form of this is enacting, shortening, and repealing stuff, but it doesn't say what the change is. And I think that's kind of what we're trying to inform the voter what the major features are, not whether it enacts something or repeals something, but what's the change? What are people really voting on? So that's my concern on that one. The prohibits future state borrowing in any form. That's not entirely true, is it? I thought you could get voter approval for borrowing. You can't?
I don't think the state can.
The emphasis here is the state. I'm sorry, you're right. It's state government as opposed to local government.
Right, yeah.
Okay. Okay, that didn't strike me.
I'm really confused.
Okay, so maybe it's state government borrowing might help me understand that a little better. But by contrast, I guess the next sentence helps clarify that local borrowing has to be voter approved. And how, again, I'm not, sorry to ask dumb questions, how is that different? Most borrowing, bonded debt has to be voter approved. Right. How is this different than when we say future local borrowing to be voter approved bonded debt?
In other words, not certificates of participation, not all of these other constructs that have been created to avoid Tabor.
Okay. Okay. Well, discussion by the board? I mean, we sort of can start working from either the proponent's alternative or work from the staff draft. Oh, thank you. Okay, so we can display both depending on which one we want, which version we want to work from. Thanks.
I'm happy to work with their proposed draft, although I do think it needs more than what they've proposed, but I agree that I think there's a lot in the staff draft that's probably unnecessary detail that shouldn't be included. So if it's easier to go with the staff draft or the proponent's proposed draft and then make changes to that, if you two are comfortable with that.
Mr. Domenico, is that okay?
That's fine with me, yeah.
Okay, well, let's start with that. And again, Ms. Gomez has that on the screen.
And I think the first change, to be consistent with our usual format, would be to take the language as it appears on the staff draft about an amendment to the Colorado Constitution rather than just, and I understand this isn't the question format versus the title format that we're working at, which is just a statement. But if we just say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution limiting government borrowing.
And consistency?
Yeah, the format, the staff draft, as they start out, it's usually either, you know, amending the Constitution or the Colorado Revised Statutes.
Now, is the word concerning also standard approach to things or format?
It sometimes is, but I don't think that I necessarily proposed the inclusion of concerning in this case.
You know, we've discussed this in prior board meetings. I like the word concerning because we are required to clearly express the single subject, and a subject is kind of a thing. And we're also required to use the rules for bill titles used by the General Assembly, and that's the convention that the General Assembly uses to express the single subject for bills. I know there's some concern about using the word concerning. I personally, and we don't have unanimity on the board on this, but I personally think for a longer measure like this that it's best to start out concerning a subject and then in a series of clauses identify the major features of the proposal. Kind of like the General Assembly does in setting titles for bills.
I suggest one, a different word, regarding.
We've had that discussion, Mr. Schroeder, certainly most recently.
How many times?
Multiple times. Certainly
I
some.
Motion,
I've always thought we could use about.
Yeah, or regarding.
But.
Because when the policeman comes to your house at 2 o'clock in the morning and says, concerning what your son just did with a car down the road,
yeah,
it has a whole different thing about regarding your son's ownership of the car.
I do think that if you go the route of concerning, then because of the two ing words, you need to change whether it's concerning limitations on government borrowing or concerning the restriction of government borrowing. I mean, you can't usually say concerning or limiting it.
I'd suggest concerning limitations on government bonding.
Borrowing,
I mean. If that's Mr.
Domenico's
not too happy, but.
No, if you're going to use, I agree. If you're going to use concerning, it should be changed. I would just say limits on.
Amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning limitations on government bonding, borrowing. And you're going to like what I'm about to say even worse, but I would then like to say, comma, and in connection therewith. I know, I have a serious
objection to that language. And the reason
I understand. I'd like to follow the standard form so that we signal that we're now doing a series of features about what the measure is doing.
I appreciate the standard form in that that is a signal to people who are accustomed to reading this sort of language in their daily lives. People who are voting at the polls are not accustomed to using that language in their daily life. And when they read these words, because they don't have a regular meaning for them, they have to stop and think. It actually impairs their ability to understand what they're reading. Normal people don't talk that way. The statutes state that ballot titles shall be brief, unambiguous, and state the principle of the provision. And when we add that type of language, it doesn't really add anything of substance to the ballot title. It simply is a cue for those who are used to reading that type of language. It's a cue to those of what's to follow.
The language would be what?
I thought it was fine the way it was.
With the change, it would be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning limitations on government bonding, comma, which repeals, enacts, and shortens?
Yes. And in connection therewith is a relevant language. It's
so
absolutely meaningless.
So the which goes back to the word amendment. It's an amendment which repeals, enacts, and shortens.
I've expressed my distaste for the in connection therewith language in the past, but I think that proposal is in incorrect grammar, actually, using which. After government borrowing, the which should signal what comes directly before it, not what comes at the beginning of the sentence. But I do think you could get rid of it and say, and then go back to ing forms of verbs, and so repealing. So you'd say in connection therewith, repealing, enacting, shortening. I think that's correct grammar, if you were going to get rid of it. But we've fought this in the past, and we're not there yet, I don't think.
We know eventually Mr. Domenico would.
The first sentence, shall there be a constitutional, shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning limitations on government borrowing? The amendment concerns limitations on government borrowing, which refers to the amendment. The entire first part of that sentence refers to the amendment. The English is correct. It's the same. In plain English, there's really no...
It was correct as you had it written. As it's amended, it would be wrong, I think, leaving the which as it is, if you get rid of the in connection therewith. So I think we should decide if we're going to leave the in connection therewith language or not, because if we are, then that makes it simple if we're going to leave it.
My biggest concern about this, I don't have an issue with any of the other changes, but my biggest concern is and in connection therewith. That makes a voter go, I don't know what you're talking about. It's meant to confuse. That's what it feels like to the voter, is that I'm trying to read about a subject and you're throwing these words in there that I never use, that I don't use in conversation, and that are actually getting in the way of me understanding the substance of what this says. I don't think it's fair to the voter to put little hurdles in there for them to climb over in trying to understand what this bill is really about.
Eubanks.
And I'm in the camp of following our standard format, especially on complicated measures that contain multiple features. I think it's very helpful to set it apart from the single subject, and so I would be in favor of Mr. Hobbs' suggestion.
Shall we move on and into the next clause? I mean, if we that leads us towards using ing words, I think, but I raised a question of whether that next clause was helpful or not. I'd be interested to know what the other board members think. Ms. Eubanks?
I don't think that it imparts any particular information to the voters. I wouldn't include it.
I guess I would suggest striking the next clause. And then the next one, prohibiting, I think if we go to an ing word, it would read prohibiting future state borrowing in any form. And I'm okay with that. Or maybe state government borrowing. Is that helpful? I mean, the next clause, if it remains similar to the way it is, it does talk about local borrowing. I don't know whether that should be local government borrowing.
The staff draft says prohibits, or what's it say, prohibiting the state from contracting any debt. That might be, if you say prohibiting, it would be awkward with future in there, the state from borrowing.
As a suggestion, could you say prohibiting future borrowing by the state in any form?
Mr. Haas?
If you capitalize the word state, does that give the state more, make it clearer to the voter?
Our usual convention of capitalization is, again, sort of following legislative rules. We don't capitalize very much. I understand that would signal it, although it's pretty subtle. I'm not sure most readers would know the difference between a lowercase s and a big S. I like Ms. Eubanks' suggestion.
Yeah, I did. I did, too.
By the state? Then you'd strike the borrowing after state. And I guess I don't know whether it matters about in any form, whether it goes up with borrowing or where it is now.
I think it should go with borrowing.
Borrowing. Okay. If you want to go ahead and strike. Okay. That's fine.
Possible suggestion on structure, order a little bit. State government borrowing.
Words have meaning. When you capitalize the word state, you mean something different than when you don't capitalize the word state. If you're going to not capitalize it, then I think that would be
What does it mean that's different?
I'm talking about the state of Colorado or the people of Colorado or the state government of Colorado. Those are three different things. And so traditionally you were saying most people don't know that when you capitalize the state, you're talking about state government. So I think that to make sure that clarity is in there of what we're talking about the ability of state governments to borrow. So I think government would help the voter understand clearly what they were reading. Even though most people don't make that distinction when they think state government or the state of Colorado, so we might find it unnecessary, but I don't think there's a problem with increased clarity.
So your suggestion, how would that read?
Future borrowing in any form by the state government, is that what you mean?
Do you need the word the?
Then we wouldn't need the, exactly.
I actually think it would be better without the, because I think that prohibition is on. When I think of the state government, I think of the legislature and the governor. And I think this does apply to state subdivisions. Mm-hmm. But so I think it's better. If we're going to do that, I think that probably is better without the and with government.
So we have prohibiting future borrowing in any form by state government, semicolon. And requiring future borrowing what, what would be next? By local government?
By local governments.
By local governments to be voter-approved bonded debt? Mm-hmm. Requiring future borrowing by local governments. Pardon me? Yes. Governments, and then strike borrowing. Ms. Eubanks?
And I guess this is a question for the proponents, and perhaps going to sort of the common citizen on the street isn't going to know what bonded debt is. I mean, generally, people don't understand the subtle distinctions between bonded debt and...
I think you underestimate the average citizen on the street. Well... The difference between what a bond is. I mean, some people don't. And if they don't, then they can look it up.
Well, there's all sorts of financial instruments, and most people don't know the distinction between those different financial instruments. And all I was wondering is whether or not... If you make this phrase to be more requiring future borrowing by local governments to be voter approved without specifying the form, because I don't know if that's very meaningful to most people reading the ballot question. And then in the next phrase, perhaps, where we're talking about limiting the dollar amount, that we could say limiting the form and dollar amount of total borrowing by local government. So that we're still trying to get across the message that there's a limitation on the form of borrowing, but I just don't know that they know the difference between the various forms of borrowing.
If you put limits the forms, I think that that's fine, as long as we're addressing that the form of debt is being addressed in that, then yeah, that's.
Guarantee with bond because we have bail bonds out there too.
But I agree with you in the sense that, let's say everyone but one voter understands bonded debt. Let's do it for that one.
Well, my guess is that there's probably a lot of folks that their lives just don't involve that amount of detail.
So let's try that.
Yeah, savings bonds also. Most the,
Ms. Eubanks, how would that?
As long as I would say that as long as it is addressed that the form of borrowing is a part of this, and that sounds.
Let's see what that would look like.
Okay, what I would suggest is saying requiring voter approval for future borrowing by local governments, semicolon. And striking the to be a voter approved bonded debt language.
Okay. I like that.
Requiring voter approval. Don't know.
No.
Voter approval of. And then striking the remainder of that phrase.
And then the next clause?
Limits. Form and dollar amount.
Limiting the form and dollar amount?
Yes.
And one concept that's in the staff draft that could go in there and isn't in this is that it also limits the term to 10 years, right? I don't know. Do you that would be an easy thing to add right there, limits the form, term, and dollar amount. Of total borrowing.
Good. Limiting the form, term, or form, comma, term, comma, and it proceeds.
Go ahead. And then I'd say instead of local entity, I'd say local government.
Not be entities other than government out there hoping to borrow.
This is one of our concerns about authorities and things like that.
Yeah, concerns about what?
Authorities and things like that.
What if
word entity? Because
I
I understand what you're saying as well.
So. Well, no, and your point's well taken. My concern is, you know, about them understanding what local entity it could be. You know, it's local because it's in the community. Whether or not we sort of meet halfway and say local government entity. Maybe we leave the entity so that it helps convey those different forms of governmental entities. And I don't know, should we say governmental, local governmental entities would be correct?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Governmental?
AL?
Yeah.
Well, there's a difference between government and governmental.
Well, if you have each, I think it should be singular.
Yes,
I guess. Jesse, I don't think we'd need, yeah.
Any feeling about?
That's governmental.
Just gotta go back to the why.
Yeah. And the strike, yeah. There.
Any votes for governmental versus government? Proponents are disagreeing? I can live with either one. I kind of prefer government, but...
I have a slight preference, I don't know why, for governmental. I think just, to me, it may be slightly broader than government entity, and I think the proponents want it to be... Mm-hmm. Broad.
If we do it this way here, should we also change it up on the voter approval clause? Because again, it's those other types of entities, such as enterprises, authorities. So at least be consistent in our terminology.
In that sense, you could, in the second part, also say local governments. And so I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think
in terms of consistency, making it consistent, I'm not in one place.
Saves a number of letters. You can do a governments.
So yeah, you could get rid of governments. You could get rid of each and change it just to local total borrowing by local governments.
Both cases, then it would be in both places.
If you do that, though, I think you need to change the beginning of that somewhat, because it doesn't limit total borrowing by local governments in the sense of all local governments added together. It is a limit on each local government, each local governmental entity. And I think it would be wrong if we just change that to local governments. You know, but I don't think we need to be consistent completely, but it may be that better to change the previous part to requiring voter approval of future borrowing by local governmental entities.
I think I'd be most comfortable with that avenue, taking that approach.
I think I would too, actually.
Okay. I would change governments.
The line above, just
right there.
Change that to local governmental entities.
And it would be plural. Yeah.
I'm not sure I have a problem with this, but I sort of preferred the language in the staff draft about the maximum amount rather than the dollar amount. It doesn't really set a dollar amount, which saying dollar amount suggests that there's some kind of dollar number in there, and what it really does is limits you to the total, whatever.
On a percentage.
10%. Yeah, it's kind of a ratio. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Take out amount, or take out dollar, and just leave limiting the amount of total borrowing. Okay. Yeah, so I'd delete dollar.
Question. When, if you take out dollar, does the amount of local borrowing then refer to or allow multiple borrowings opposed to if you have a dollar amount? The city of Sheridan can only borrow X number of dollars regardless of what
out in Tabor.
I think it's okay this way.
I mean, the limit really goes to the entity.
Yeah.
It's a limit on the borrowing by the entity, and whether that, at least in my mind, is done through one loan or multiple borrowings. I mean, it's just a limit on total borrowing, and I think that conveys the concept that it's really not getting into the how many borrowings there is. It's just a limit on the total.
Yeah, I think I like it as is, that part at least.
Next clause, directing all current borrowing to be paid. Any changes?
I don't know if I have a change, and maybe this is an incorrect assumption on my point. I just would assume that borrowing would be repaid.
It's not, that's the default issue. It's mostly checks that are applied in order to weasel out. Borrow money, you're going to pay it back, and so that kind of addresses the section that talks about no default. You can't use this, well, we can always renege on our promises if we can't afford to pay or we don't want to. And so, and that is addressing a piece of that specific piece. In other words, the part that says you may default.
And would you say that that's a major component of your measure?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. And reducing tax rates after certain borrowing is fully repaid? Anything else? Any additions?
Because of this format, I don't think there should be the question mark. It should just be a period.
And it's understood we will also have a title that's in the form of a question as well that'll be identical. So, any further discussion? If not, is there a motion to adopt the draft as amended?
So moved.
Second.
For the record, Ms. Gomez, perhaps I'll read it into the record, and Ms. Gomez will probably display it so that it will be easier for me to do that. It would read, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning limitations on government borrowing, comma, and it, comma, in connection therewith, comma, prohibiting future borrowing in any form by state government, semicolon, requiring voter approval of future borrowing by local governmental entities, semicolon, limiting the form, comma, term, comma, and amount of total borrowing by each local governmental entity, semicolon, directing all current borrowing to be paid, semicolon, and reducing tax rates after certain borrowing is fully repaid, period. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That completes action on number 18. I think number 21, I don't think we have to take a vote on single subject, but I think that the vote would likely be about the same. And I assume the title may be about the same. So let's turn to number 21. Just for the record, the time is 2:50, 1 p.m. And since I think the discussion is the same, we can incorporate our previous discussion on number 18 on single subject, and I'll go ahead and make a motion that the board find that number 21 comprises a single subject and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no.
No.
That motion carries 2-1. Then with respect to the draft of the titles, I would think that the titles would be the same. Is that correct?
I think that's correct.
Opponents agree? They're on the record for saying they will only circulate one. Then I'll go ahead and move that the titles for number 21 be the same as the titles for number 18.
Second.
Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And that concludes action on number 21 as well. And the time is 2:52 p.m. And we're done with those two agenda items. Okay. Thank you. Do you want to take a break?
I'm okay.
The next agenda item, are we ready? Okay. Is 2009-2010, number 19. Again, for the record, the time is 2:54 p.m. And let's first hear from opponents. If you'll introduce yourselves and who you represent.
I'm Chris Kennedy. I'm a citizen and a proponent.
My name is Josh Cunningham. I'm also representing the proponents.
Okay, thank you. So let me find out first from the board if there are questions about the measure. Again, we want to make sure we understand the measure, so I'll turn to questions from the board. Ms. Eubanks.
Thank you. In terms of the language that is in the introductory portion to subsection 1, where you're referring to monies in the state general fund not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, could you give me some examples of what you're referring to there?
That would include things such as Amendment 23.
But Amendment 23 doesn't have monies going to the general fund.
It requires it's talking about the appropriation of the monies in the general fund, so Amendment 23 does require a certain level of appropriation.
Oh, in terms of the maintenance of effort requirement, not necessarily the monies that are going to the state education fund.
We're talking about the appropriations coming, monies going from the general fund to...
Okay. Great. In paragraph A, I'm sort of confused on what, if anything, that paragraph does. And since I work for the legislature, usually their power is plenary, except we're limited by the Constitution, and so they don't need to be empowered by anything in the Constitution. If they can do anything unless it's been restricted. And so I'm confused in terms of what this provision's trying to do by saying it's not empowering the General Assembly?
The thing is, General Assembly would not have the ability to set any new limits on appropriations that would extend beyond the year in which their session was to operate.
I guess our intent was that this was a clarification of the first subsection, saying that in every given year, the General Assembly shall have the ability to allocate all funds, but that they shall not have the ability to enact a restriction on a future General Assembly.
Okay. And I can see where you can read that. I just, you know, when you've already said they're authorized to do this, and then you're saying there's nothing to be, you know, construed to empower, I got a little confused. Can we talk a minute about the idea of a limitation about in future fiscal years? For example, what the General Assembly was doing this past session was setting, in not only dealing with changes to the current fiscal year, but they were also setting the budget for the 9-10 fiscal year, for example. And so this General Assembly couldn't establish a limit for the 9-10 fiscal year. Is that, am I reading your language about in future fiscal years? They can only do it in the fiscal, they could only impose a limitation once they're in that fiscal year, and after they've already set the budget initially, then they could impose a limitation?
Yes, in our minds it's distinct that passing the budget long bill would be different than enacting a limitation, although open-minded to what you're suggesting.
Well, and it's only because they enact the budget prior to the commencement of the fiscal year. So whether or not, I just don't know whether a limitation really could ever be imposed except after the fact, once you're already in a budget year, then they decide to impose a limitation on themselves and make changes to the budget for that year that they're in.
The intent was to say that they can, when they're working on a fiscal year budget, such as 09-10, that is within their discretion to impose any limits for that legislation they're working on.
But that is a future fiscal year, because they're not currently in it?
Help me understand if maybe we're not saying they're setting a limit on themselves. They're appropriating funds for the next few years. They're not establishing a new statutory limit. Maybe I'm wrong in thinking those are two different things.
Well, it seems, talking about in future fiscal years, it seems to imply they can do it in a current fiscal year. So let's take 8-9. Could they then somehow impose a limit on themselves? And just for example, like a 6% limit or a 5% limit or whatever you want to, whatever limit they might come up with during a current fiscal year that they're in, but it just seemed like they either can or they can't,
I think
consistent with what's in one, but what's your language?
I think what this states is that way I read it is that they could impose a limit such as a 6% limit on the current fiscal year, and that I think the way this reads that they would not be able to do it for the next fiscal year for 09-10, but when they do get into that session and they're doing supplementals, they would have the ability to change that.
So they could set a budget for 9-10 as they did now. It'll take effect July 1st, and then if they decide they want to impose a limit on themselves when they come in next January, they could do so, but that would probably be the only scenario.
That's the way I think it reads, yeah.
Okay. And then in terms of the reference to a reserve fund in paragraph B, since we're talking the general fund, any fund that exists in the Treasury other than the general fund is called a cash fund. It could be called a reserve fund. it could be called a trust fund, whatever they want to name it, but it's a separate and distinct fund. Since you've called it a reserve fund, is paragraph B dealing with a fund other than the general fund?
That was in response to a comment in the comment and review hearing, and that's referring to is it was brought up that, you know, there's times when they don't appropriate the full general fund and the remainder is held as a reserve. So this is simply saying that nothing in this requires them to appropriate all of the general fund. It just gives them the ability, and that therefore if they wanted to restrain themselves from appropriating the entire general fund, they may do so. And if they want to, as typically that's called a reserve.
And that's true, and those monies are held in the general fund, but you've called it a reserve fund, which means, at least it implies to me, that perhaps then those monies are moved elsewhere to a separate and distinct reserve fund rather than just being held in reserve in the general fund?
I think that that would be, we say that they may decline to appropriate all monies remaining in the general fund, and I think that that would just fit within their discretion. As defined in the first.
Okay. And then I was just curious, in looking at the form of the measure that was submitted for review and comment versus the form that's been submitted to the title board, there's been substantial changes. And in terms of the title board having jurisdiction to set a title for the measure, the changes that are made between review and comment and being submitted to the title board have to be in direct response to questions made that came up during the review and comment. And I've even got your marked up version that you filed and your explanations of which questions in the review and comment memo are tied to the changes. But I'm still a little concerned because the measure is changed substantially from the original version, and whether or not all those changes were made. For example, you just referenced that there was a comment about the statutory reserve in the general fund, but there wasn't any question in the review and comment memo about the reserve, and of course you've only referenced the technical comment 7 in terms of the format for paragraphs and subsections, and so I'm just concerned that all the changes that were made to the draft are actually in direct response to the review and comment hearing.
If you listen to the recording of the review and comment hearing, there's about a 5-minute discussion that was brought up by asking about the reserve and suggesting that we add language to address that. Why we felt that it was acceptable to include that line in there as a direct response to a comment that was made.
Okay. And then the other question I have is in terms of what's referred on the strike type and underlined, so showing the changes made between review and comment and submitting to the title board, it seems to deviate from the language in the final text of the measure before us, and I'm referring specifically to the language in the introductory portion to subsection 1. It talks about monies in the state general fund, and I'm reading from the final text, not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions in its discretion. Whereas the marked up version says monies in the state general fund not previously dedicated by this constitution or lawfully obligated by a previous general assembly in its discretion. And so in terms of, I'm curious about the difference, and I don't know if that affects the title board's ability to set a title in terms of having jurisdiction because you haven't complied with the statutory requirements of what all has to be filed for consideration by the title board?
think that was possibly intended to be the same in both, and we made a wording choice which was supposed to express the same intent, but it was a choice of wording, and that we just did not get it updated on the
amended version. On the final
that has
text?
The strike-throughs. No, I think the final text is correct.
Okay.
And then the version that has the strike-throughs does not have the current language. Right, Josh?
Yeah, I think for some reason that where it says or lawfully obligated was intended to have been removed. But I don't know if that really, I think you can say that fits within, yet again, lawfully obligated fits within the discretion of. Of the final version.
I don't know that it's really an issue of the meaning. It's whether you've complied procedurally with the requirements of the statute for the measure to be properly before us. And I don't know if Mr. Kneiser has any advice for us on that matter.
Well, maybe when we get to
okay.
Well,
and that's fine.
Yeah.
However you want to deal with it.
And was that? But that was the one instance where there was a discrepancy between the highlighted changes and the final version. Is that correct?
As far as I could tell.
Okay. Further questions for the proponents? Mr. Domenico.
Just a follow-up to, I think, a couple of things Ms. Eubanks brought up. This subsection B, if the General Assembly declines to appropriate all monies 1 year, puts the money into a reserve fund, can it attach strings to that reserve fund, or does it just have to go back into the general fund and then the next year's General Assembly can do whatever it wants with all the new money that comes in plus the reserve fund?
I think that would probably fit within its discretion as long as it's not limiting the ability for the next year's General Assembly. You know what the first section says, all monies in the general fund. As long as they're not, they can attach strings to it, so long as it's not limiting the ability of the next year's General Assembly, next session, to build their powers that are granted.
So if this year, or next year, let's say, the General Assembly miraculously doesn't appropriate all the money that's in the general fund, and they put some $1 million, say, into what you call this reserve fund, and they say this $1 million can only be used for either school capital construction or emergency relief or something like that. Then the year after that, the General Assembly comes in, say there's a new election, and they say, well, we want all the money that's coming in this year. Plus, we think that was a silly thing to dedicate that reserve fund to. We're going to use that for something else, transportation. Who could they do? Could the new General Assembly take that money even though it was put in with strings attached?
I think that under the current rules, they would still have the ability to do that. And they can change a statute or, you know, a statute. So that would be something I would assume would be placed via statute in the next year's session.
So this is kind of my basic question, I guess. What do you intend to change? And what it seems to me that a lot of A and B is meant to make clear what you're not trying to change. What are you trying to change?
We're trying to say that there shouldn't be any caps placed on appropriations. An example would be the Arbuckle Byrd limit that Senate Bill 228 appears to have repealed. Another example would be the 5%. Personal income growth limit that exists. This would remove any sort of cap on the amount of. It would say that whatever general funds are collected and whatever revenue is placed in the general fund may be appropriated fully, with without any limitation as to the amount that they can.
Okay. Do you intend to otherwise? I understand how that interplays with Tabor, but do you intend to have it do anything else to Tabor? For example, if we were to eventually go over back over Tabor revenue limits someday after Ref C expires, would the state still be required to give Tabor refunds? Or not? My reading, I can tell you, my initial reading is that that's an existing dedication of money by the Constitution, but I just wasn't sure if we were in agreement on that.
This was not our original intention with the bill to overthrow the Tabor refunds, although we've read that in the revised version as well, that that's a possible interpretation.
And I think that that's something that if it were to be challenged, a court would have to decide, and that's not necessarily something that we can think you can interpret it either way. But they're saying that existing constitutional provisions includes the table limit.
I agree that that's not up to any of us to interpret it, but I'm curious what your intent is.
Our intent was to simply remove any limitation to general fund appropriations.
We originally developed the initiative when we were unsure whether or not Senate Bill 228 was likely to pass. It was partially a backup plan. And in some senses, we've been unsatisfied with the compromise that was made on the final version of 228, which is why we've continued to move forward with it rather than withdraw after 228 appeared to have passed. I guess that's...
Okay. I mean, fair enough. Just I'm asking because I work for the Attorney General. If this were to pass, it'd be my job to defend it with Mr. Kneiser. We often try to figure out what the proponents intended. We need to make our language reflect both the language of the measure but not contradict the intent. So I want to make sure we're all on the same page.
And did I understand proponents to say you don't express any opinion about whether or not your measure would allow the General Assembly to appropriate monies that otherwise would have to be refunded under Tabor?
Our intent was with this was not to repeal or supersede any section of Tabor.
So Tabor refunds would still apply?
I think that that would have to be decided by a court and not necessarily. I mean, I'm not a lawyer and I
think he's asking whether or not our official position is that we don't know whether or not this contradicts the Tabor refunds. And I think based on the idea that a court would have to decide, I believe that our answer is yes, we do not have an official opinion.
I mean, you know, and it's fairly common when language comes before us and there's uncertainty about the meaning, if you express an intent, it becomes part of the legislative history and may be taken into account when the courts do get an opportunity to interpret it. But I think I hear you declining to express an intent.
That's correct.
Is that still correct?
I mean, like we said, it can be interpreted in different ways. I think I'll stick with the fact that it was our intent was not to repeal Tabor, and if it had been, then we probably would have included something that...
Okay. Ms. Eubanks?
But based on that comment, I mean, you are intending by this measure to get around the current voter approval requirement for weakening other limits that is contained in subsection 1 of Tabor, aren't you?
I think if it's found that the Arvascal bird limit is considered a weakening, then...
Right.
But I think that's still up for interpretation, and if so, then we would be weakening a limit. Yes, I don't think we are in any way. I don't think we're overriding the necessity of voter approval to weaken a limit. I think if you want to interpret it as us weakening a limit, that's still to be determined. But we are seeking voter approval. So if you on appropriation, so if you define appropriation limits as a weakening or as a spending limit, then
well, let's just play out a scenario.
Okay.
In terms of Senate Bill 228 is ruled to violate Tabor in terms of it is the type of limit that requires prior voter approval under subsection 1. And then your measure passes, then that same 6% limit on general fund appropriations could be repealed without any further voter approval. Your measure would have voter approval, but then it could be repealed and sort of eliminate that whole Tabor issue. Is that correct? That would be one possible way it would play out?
I think, yeah, if Senate Bill 228 were to be deemed unconstitutional and found that it was weakening a spending limit that Tabor would have to seek voter approval for, I think that this would, I guess we use the word backup, but it would supersede whatever decision is made on Senate Bill 228. Because it is a voter. If it's found that this is a weakening of a limit, then we would be seeking voter approval to do so, which complies with Tabor.
Although I don't know that it would retroactively save 228, but at least
it
would open the door to
similar
legislation in
the
future.
Thing.
Okay. Since you were saying you weren't intending to affect a Tabor at all, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute here. I just wanted to clarify.
Right.
Okay, if there's no other questions, then let's turn to jurisdictional issues. Ms. Eubanks?
Well, since I raised sort of the procedural jurisdictional issues and with comments, some input from Mr. Kneiser, in terms of substantial compliance, there's probably at least the argument for the title board to having jurisdiction to set a title, but the proponents need to understand that there's a risk here that your measure could be challenged on the basis that you have not fully complied with the statute. I mean, and that's a risk, I guess, you know, you have to decide whether you're willing to take. You could resubmit and clear up this grounds for challenge if you wish to do that. I understand your odd year election timing issue, but and so obviously that's a decision for you to make, but I think I'm fine with Mr. Kneiser's input about at least having the argument that there has been substantial compliance, and that enables the title board to have jurisdiction to set a title.
There, Mr. Atwood, did you want to testify on this issue?
Yes, I want to testify, and I'm speaking in opposition to this, and I've got...
Do you want to testify on the jurisdictional issues, either single subject or other jurisdictional issues?
Yes, that's part of what I'll be
okay. Do you want to go ahead and come forward then and give us your testimony?
If I may.
Please.
I am here to speak against proposed initiative 2009-2010-19. I ask this document to be made part of the record. Problems with initiative 2009-2010-19. CRS 1-40-104 requires designating two persons, that the filing of number 19 with this title board designated five people. It's thus an illegal filing. No provision of the law allows this board to arbitrarily remove excess representatives. There is no authority for proponents who show up to delete names of others who did not. Once an illegal filing occurs, it cannot be made legal retroactively. Further, number 19 says the proponents include, which imply there may be still others beyond the five listed. That is also illegal. Did the proponents meet the legal requirements to file drafts marked original, revised, and final with the board? 1-40-105, section 4, SCRS requires that even if all three were submitted as required with highlighting, the major changes require a new hearing. The original two-sentence text is totally different than what was filed here as final text. The second sentence of the original text has completely disappeared here. The first sentence was with no placement in the Constitution or statutes, no enactment clause, no numbering, no clarity, and many other problems. Normal staff practice is to give a new initiative number to each revision, yet this was filed with the title board as number 19. It cannot be number 19 because it's been so radically changed. They are misusing the old number to evade review of the new text. This is fraud on the public, which has a right to the hearing. Ed DeGreco, Checo, of Legislative Legal Services said, no new version was filed with Legislative Legal Services after number 19's hearing on May 4th, and therefore no letter exists waiving a review and comment hearing. Such hearing is required by Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5 of the Constitution. There has been no such hearing on the initiative draft before you. That is illegal, too. The statutory process must also be followed to indicate there are no further questions, because all changes were discussed at the public meeting. 1-40-105, subsection 2, CRS says, if there is any substantial amendment not in response to direct questions, the amended petition shall be resubmitted to the directors for the comments. If the directors have no additional comments concerning the amended petition, they may so notify the proponents in writing, and in such case, a hearing on the amended petition is not required. They did not resubmit their massively amended petition, and no waiver letter was filed, so they evaded public review and staff analysis on whether to hold another public hearing. 1-40-105, Section 3 CRS requires this draft be worded with simplicity and clarity and not cause confusion among voters. This draft is unintelligible, so this board cannot set a title because it cannot be understood by this board or general citizens. You cannot set a title for a text you can't understand. Upon rejection of this petition, proponents must start over. The measure cannot be on the 209 ballot anyway, because it's not a matter that can be subject to an off-year election. Not a tax or debt issue on which Tabor requires a vote. For the legislative finding of Senate Bill 09-228, presumed constitutional, no vote to weaken statutory spending limits is required. Legislators concluded that from the Supreme Court ruling on the Ritter property tax increase case, one can't even tell if Tabor is involved at all, since the one Tabor mentioned and the draft number 19 is gone. Also, you cannot set a later title for 2009 elections. This is the last day per 1-40-106, section 1, CRS, last sentence. The final text also has a subsection 1, but with no subsection 2. That contradicts the staff's advice in its question 7 and is not in direct response per 1-40-105. Section 2 CRS, but in direct defiance. A similar result occurs with the enactment clause of the Constitution, Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 8, and staff in Question 1, both require to be in upper and lower case, not all capitals. The title of this new Section 22 is also in all capitals, unlike current practice. The text does not define general fund. If its definition is not in the Constitution and can currently be changed at any time by statute, what does this constitutional text do that a later later statute cannot undo by change in definition. It's not clear. The text phrase, not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, was not part of the original draft, and its meaning has not been analyzed and discussed in the comment and review hearing required by the Constitution. The text does not identify limits being weakened under Tabor Section 20, Section 1, Subsection 1. It's only the Avisbara-Byrd limit. Also, does this repeal or weaken Senate Bill 09-228? If Senate Bill 09-228 is approved by the governor in coming weeks, is this petition trying to approve Senate Bill 09-228, which it believes to be currently unconstitutional under Tabor, as lacking voter approval? Can a petition approve an unconstitutional statute? Senate Bill 02-228 sets a different limit than current law. Will that be approved or repealed? This title board can't set a title if it doesn't know what the measure does. Since limits can be weakened by a voter-approved statute, why is this proposed for the Constitution? It appears to give the General Assembly discretion, but takes away the power of future General Assemblies to use that discretion to establish a new appropriation limit. That appears to be two different purposes and thus two subjects. They are not necessarily or properly connected, they are contradictory. That violates Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5.5 and 1-40-106.5 CRS. It also violates 1-40-106 Section 2, Subsection B CRS last sentence, which requires this board's title shall unambiguously state the principle of the provision sought to be added. That means there can be only one principle involved, not two or three conflicting ones. In Section 1, Subsection A, the submitted text addresses the power of the General Assembly to establish limits on itself. That was not included in the original draft and contradicts that original intent. There was no public hearing on this contradictory purpose. It's also ambiguous. It says nothing in this subsection shall empower the General Assembly to establish limitations. The General Assembly has that inherent power now. Is it being removed? The text says only that this subsection shall not empower them. Is that a total prohibition or just explanation of what this petition does not empower? Now, how can a petition state what it is not doing? Is that a separate subject? What in the prior sentence would require such an explanation? Nothing. The text goes from allowing unlimited appropriations in one, forbidding limits on appropriations maybe in one, Section 1, Subsection A, to saying in Section 1, Subsection B, they can reduce their current appropriations. Allowing more spending, banning limits on more spending maybe, and allowing more savings, the opposite of spending, is there a single purpose? No. Under Section 1, Subsection A, would a statutory limit on appropriations be allowed since future legislatures have the power to change existing statutes, or would it become illegal to pass a law that a General Assembly would have the burden to repeal to avoid its limits? This is another subject of limiting the inherent power to legislate in addition to allowing unlimited general fund spending, not empowering limits in a reserve fund. Is the reserve fund under Section 1, Subsection B, something that can be made limited access so the General Assembly cannot empty it at any time? If not, how is that a reserve fund? How does it relate to spending appropriation and lack of limits, the ban on future limits? I ask this title board to rule it lacks jurisdiction and that number 19 has multiple fatal legal flaws in its content and its procedural errors. Thank you, John.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Atwood? Can I go back? I think you touched upon single subject issues, but could you explain, Mr. Atwood, where I didn't mark it at the time when you were going through your material, but you do have an objection to the measure on the grounds of single subject. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
And could you just summarize that again for me? why there's more than one subject. I think it's at the top of page, the third page.
Okay. Yes, that's where we get into the, that's the paragraph discussing that there's two subjects, what appears to be two different purposes and thus two subjects.
And what are the, just summarize the two subjects.
It appears to be giving them discretion, then it takes away the power from future General Assemblies and establishes new appropriation limits.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Atwood? Thank you.
I don't have anyone else
signed up to testify. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on jurisdictional issues? And I will provide an opportunity. I just want to see if there's anybody else who had objections to the measure. Okay, then let's hear from the proponents and their response to the objections.
Would you like us to address all of the points, or are there specific items that are of greater concern?
It's up to you. I don't know. I mean, I think what I do want to be out of here by 4 o'clock because we have some limitations. So I want to speed it up.
Right.
I also don't want to deprive you of an opportunity to respond to things, and I don't know what the sense of the other board members is with respect to their issues. And then maybe one way to do it is to get a little board discussion first to see if there's issues that we want to focus on, and then provide the proponents an opportunity to respond to that. Would that be okay?
We could certainly address the single subject question right now if you'd like.
Sure, I think that would be good.
Mr. Atwood has stated that we've both given power to General Assemblies and restricted on others. I believe that is not what our language says. What we've done is we've given limited authority to the General Assemblies that did not have before. And what we're saying in subsection A is that this does not provide a different kind of authority from the first half. Does that make sense?
I think I understand.
I could have done better, but.
Well, let's go through some of the other issues. One of the issues had to do with the highlighting problem. It sounds like there's one issue, one provision that was not properly marked, so that the clean version does not accurately reflect the changes that are indicated. As Ms. Eubanks referenced, I think the standard is substantial compliance. We have a court case, at least one court case on that, Amendment 1996-3-917, P. 2nd, 1274. I think is the case where basically the court said it's a three-part substantial compliance test. The three factors are the extent of noncompliance, the purpose for which the requirement exists, and here I think it's to let the public see, be able to compare the review and comment version versus the final version. I'm assuming that's the purpose. And the third factor is the good faith efforts on the part of proponents to comply. Seems to me with one violation, I mean, I would just throw out that maybe there is substantial compliance. This is not like there were a number of instances that would indicate, and I think this has happened, where it looked almost like the proponents were not being forthcoming with some of the changes, but here I'm assuming that it sounds like from what the proponents have said it was an inadvertent mistake. The injury to the public is probably pretty minor, but I mean it seems to me there's substantial compliance here. Any disagreement by the board? Mr. Domenico?
Well, I'm not sure I disagree. I am kind of troubled. The one part that I guess should have been struck and is struck in what's in front of us but wasn't in the highlighted redline version, that makes sense. There's also, though, the fact that a lot of these, as Ms. Eubanks pointed out, a lot of the changes, even those that are reflected in the strike-through version, are, it's hard to tie them to a direct response to a question, as far as I can tell.
Do you have an example?
Well, B is one. I'm not sure what, I mean, I know you referred us to the oral transcript, but in a lot of ways this seems to me that, well, I mean, I'm not sure. In some ways it seems why, and I don't have the comments in front of me, but what about comment number 10 caused you to get rid of the reference to Tabor?
I believe the question was asked if that constituted a second subject, and our answer at the time was no, that was never our intention. What we were trying to say with that sentence was that what we're doing here is within the realm of Tabor. By saying originally that the will of the people of Colorado shall be affirmed through a popular vote, we're basically saying with this, that will is affirmed by the people of Colorado. So basically, that was converted into the first sentence, which is now, be it enacted by the people of the state of Colorado, which is also part of the comment on the correct form.
At the time of the original, when we submitted the original draft, we were not aware of all the traditional standard formatting. And so through the review and comment hearing, we were informed of that and made the appropriate changes.
Well, and I appreciate that. It just seems to have changed fairly substantively from the original version to what's in front of us now, and that's usually less than that seems to happen from what I can tell, where the review and comment is really to kind of clean things up, make sure you're not putting in something on accident. And these seem to be more than just formatting changes.
I mean, if you read comment number 10, I have the comment memo right here. So what does the second sentence of the proposed initiative mean? Is it a description of what the proposed initiative is supposed to be doing? Does it mean that approval of this section by the electors of the state shall constitute future voter approval of a weakening of another spending limit as required by Section 20, subsection, or Article 20, or sorry, Section 20, Subsection 1 of Article 10 of the Colorado Constitution? And so their interpretation of that second sentence was not at all what our intent, original intent was, and so their suggestion was that we modify that, because we weren't. I mean, what did they say? They say approval list by the electors of the state shall constitute future voter approval, but in no way was it meant to constitute future voter approval. By as a direct response to that comment, obviously. Our intent was not being communicated. And so,
okay.
We would furthermore argue that substantively we did not change what the initiative would do. You can argue that there's substantial changes to the language, but I would say that there's no substantive change.
And one of the things, one of the cases on this in 1992 found that a measure violated, this provision. But the language of the court then was, they said there was a violation because the measure differs so substantially. This isn't entirely a quote, but differs so substantially from the language submitted for review and comment that the revised version, in effect, constitutes a new proposal requiring resubmission to the legislative offices. And to me, it's a little high. That's a fairly high standard. I'm not sure I, at this point, that I get the sense that this is a new proposal, but it's quite that it's a lot of changes.
Right, it's changes in wording and words, but the meaning is. In my opinion, worded more according to what the review and comment hearing.
There is another issue that I that's troubling to me, and I don't mean to jump around here, but another one is the statutory requirement to designate two petition representatives, and you have five, I think.
I actually have the statute right in front of me, and it says at the time of filing, proponents must designate, this is filing with the Secretary of State. At the time of filing, proponents must designate the names and addresses of at least two persons whom all notices or information concerning the initiative are to be mailed. Phone numbers, fax numbers, and email addresses for the designated representatives are necessary so that the proponents may be contacted on all matters. It says at least two, not that only two.
Really? What section are you looking at?
This is CRS 1-40-104 and 1-40-105, subsection 4. This is a part of the initiative and referendum procedures and guidelines manual that is found on the Secretary of State website.
Wondering if we're up to date. I'm sorry, I'm a little confused here. I'm starting with 1-40-104, which is entitled Designated Representatives. It says the version I'm looking at, 2008. At the time of any filing of a draft as provided in this article, the proponent shall designate the names and mailing addresses of two persons who shall represent the proponents in all matters affecting the petition and to whom all notices or information concerning the petition shall be mailed.
Is it correct that that's addressing our original submission to the Office of Legislative and Legal Services and that there were different requirements for our submission to the Secretary of State?
Well, it says at the time of any filing of a draft as provided in this article.
Can we bring you what we have from the language that we're looking at?
Does it shows, is this a printout from the Secretary of State's website?
Yes.
Correct. It's part of the procedure, initiative and referendum procedures and guidelines, 2009-2010.
Let's assume our version on our website is wrong. Okay. I mean, that's what you're representing. In the interest of time, I don't know that, the question will be whether or not that changes the statutory requirement.
Does the statute say that it has to be limited to two?
Well, it says two. It doesn't say at least two, which, although I'm a little puzzled why, it is puzzling to me why the version on the Secretary of State's website would be different, because there has been no amendment according to the book. Mr. Atwood, if you'll come to the microphone then, and perhaps you can clarify that.
On the Frank Atwood, on page 3, it says proposals must
be page 3 of what?
Page 3 of the Secretary of State's Initiative and Referendum Procedure and Guideline 2009-2010. Page 3, it says proposals must include the names and address of two people who will act as proponents for the measure. And then on page 4, it says at the time of filing, proponents must designate the name and addresses of at least two persons.
It says so at least two?
At least two. So it's a distinction on page 3 and 4, and I'll give you my copy here.
Can I just jump in and say it doesn't make it the least bit of difference to me what the statute, even if it just says two, they have two people, they have a bunch of other people on there. To me, that serves no purpose looking at the substantial compliance language you just talked about. Limiting it to two serves absolutely no purpose, whereas trying to keep fairly substantive changes serves some purpose at least. And so I don't see how that possibly could be a problem. If we're going to say that the other problems are not sufficient. So I don't think, for me, I'm fighting over what the statute says. Unless it says, and absolutely no more than two, it doesn't matter to me.
And you may be right. I mean, and it may be a substantial compliance question anyway. There are some ramifications. There are notices that have to go to petition representatives. There's another statute that says the petition representatives can withdraw a measure. There are some implications, but it may be substantial compliance. Mr. Kneiser?
Yeah, there was a case some years ago which basically said that the failure to designate two persons to receive mail notices was not jurisdictional.
Okay. And that was the failure to have
two.
Okay. Other issues with respect to jurisdiction?
I think I briefly respond to the challenge on single subject referring to subsection B, I believe the reserve statement. That phrase adds no new action or no new action or authority, but it is simply just a clarification of the first section and an indirect response to the review and comment hearing. So to say that it is an entirely new subject, we're just clarifying that a reserve is also considered within the discretion.
Yeah, I don't think it's a separate subject. I'm troubled by whether it's a significant change. It seems to me that what happened was you guys submitted something, and in review and comment and working through it, decided. I mean, there's the main substantive change is really carving out Amendment 23 and maybe Tabor refunds. And B, it's a little unclear to me how substantive that change is. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm not sure whether your intent was originally to just have a flat measure with no exceptions, and then you decided for whatever reason you needed them in there, or if you always intended this. And that's what's hard without your pointing to anything in the memo other than the technical question about or technical comment about formatting. It's a little harder to understand, but I agree it's not a separate subject. It's a question about whether we're into this is a separate measure or a different measure, even if it's basically got the same guts to it, but I think I'm okay with it.
I think based on what I've heard and in the interest of time, I think I'm just going to go ahead and make a motion to see where the board is on this, to say that the motion would be that the board find that it does have jurisdiction, that the measure complies with the single subject requirement, and that we proceed to set titles.
Second.
Further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. And let's turn to the staff draft, which Ms. Gomez is displaying on the screen. Have the proponents had an opportunity to look at the staff draft, and do you have any comments?
We have looked at it. Our suggestion would be to, I apologize for not having a printed copy of this, but to strike out elimination of restrictions on the, and therefore it would just say, shall there be an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the power of the General Assembly to appropriate all monies from the State General Fund? We'd add all in between appropriate and money, and change money to monies.
So the change was to drop the phrase, the elimination of restrictions on, and then to change the phrase to appropriate money to say to appropriate all monies.
Correct.
I'm a little concerned that simply saying concerning the power of the General Assembly to appropriate all monies kind of loses the effect of this. I'm not sure the reader really grasps it as quickly as the staff draft sets it out. But that's just my first reaction. Would anybody else, Mr. Atwood, or anyone else, wish to comment on the staff draft or the proponent's suggested change? Okay, thank you. Then I'll turn to board discussion. Any changes to the staff draft? Ms. Eubanks?
I'm mulling over the proponent's suggested changes. I'm not sure I'm completely comfortable with what they've proposed. One of the ideas in looking at the staff draft that I had thought about is the fact that this may be one of those circumstances where we could eliminate concerning, because it is a fairly simple measure that we could just say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution eliminating restrictions, with that idea that that's where I was at the time I was looking at this. Now, whether what it would be changed to if we acted on the proponent's suggestions about removing the references to restrictions. The other thing that concerns me a little bit is both with the staff draft and even as the proponents have suggested, we haven't eliminated all restrictions, because there is the requirement that those monies not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, so that there still may be some constitutional limitations on the authority of the General Assembly, and that concept is not recognized in either the staff draft or as the proponents proposed. Right now I'm still leaning towards eliminating restrictions, whether we deal with the existing restrictions as making an exception or eliminating some restrictions. I don't know how helpful that is to voters, but just saying, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning the power of the General Assembly to appropriate all monies doesn't really tell them what that power is. By eliminating restrictions, it at least conveys the concept that if there are any restrictions out there, other than dealing with those constitutional mandates, that those restrictions are lifted and they're free to appropriate all monies. But those are just my initial thoughts on the title.
And simple title, I am okay saying an amendment to the Colorado Constitution eliminating restrictions on the power of the General Assembly, et cetera. Well, I agree with your other comments. I don't have a good idea, though, on how to improve.
Whether or not, and possibly it's because we know what we're talking about, and the voters won't know necessarily what's being referred to here in terms of primarily statutory limitations. You have the sort of the language dealing with existing limitations on the General Assembly's power to appropriate general fund monies. Whether you could at least get the concept across about that there are still some restrictions to say, eliminating non-constitutional restrictions, because I think that's what the effect would be of the measure, is we're dealing with statutory limitations rather than constitutional limitations. Might be a way of dealing with my other concern.
I might have one other suggestion, where perhaps instead of elimination, at least we could talk about this saying prohibition of restrictions.
Is it a prohibition on restrictions? Sorry, I actually have to go back and reread it. It talks about, maybe it is. Well, I don't know. not currently obligated by
what
existing.
What if we were to, I'm sorry.
I guess I'm just hung up by it says not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, but I guess the overarching power to appropriate would reach future restrictions as well.
That's good. Yeah, as I read this, the A and B really are meant to make clear that this what this doesn't do and are kind of there to avoid potential problems. And the first sentence is really where the action is. Could we just say something like an amendment to the Colorado Constitution giving the General Assembly power to appropriate all monies in the state general fund not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, and basically just paste the first sentence in there, or giving it.
Could you say that again?
Well, it would basically just say an amendment to the Colorado Constitution giving, granting, reserving, whatever verb you want to use, authorizing the General Assembly or the discretion, or however you want to say it, giving the General Assembly the power to appropriate all monies, and then just quote the rest of the first sentence.
Well, how about empowering the General Assembly to appropriate all monies in the state general fund not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions?
I would think the proponents think they already have that power. Of course, they also already think that this is maybe not necessary anyway, so maybe that's okay.
Mm-hmm. We actually like your suggestion quite a lot.
I can't remember what was my
what was my verb?
Either way, giving, but either giving or empowering, I think.
Yeah, verb is the only place I have trouble, and then the rest, I think, just pasting it in there is the way to go.
So your suggestion is to say, empowering the General Assembly to appropriate all monies in the state general fund not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions.
That would work, I think, for me.
I don't know if I'd need the discretion part, but And the only other thing I would do, and I know this is just me, is that monies aren't really appropriated from a fund. I mean, they're monies in a fund that are appropriated. Appropriating that doesn't move them, and the idea that from somehow moves them from the general fund. And to appropriate monies in the state general fund. Sorry, just. But I'm fine with Mr. Domenico's changes.
Oh, empowering the General Assembly to appropriate money in the state general fund?
Monies.
Did we talk at some point about saying all monies or just?
Yes.
And the measure does say that.
In, and then get rid of from, and put in all before monies.
Then whether you want the discretion language.
I can live without it, but I say we put it in just because.
Sounds like it.
I suggest we put it in.
So an amendment to the Colorado Constitution empowering the General Assembly to appropriate all monies in the state general fund, not currently obligated by existing constitutional provisions, in its discretion.
Can I make a suggestion? And this is only because, and I know this is how the measure is written, but when you talk about in its discretion, the fact that it's that phrase is so far away from the reference to General Assembly, whether it would be helpful to say empowering the General Assembly, comma, in its discretion, comma, to appropriate all monies in the state general fund not currently obligated, blah, blah, blah.
I'll move that.
Second.
The understanding is that the lines 5 through 7 would be conformed to be the same language but in the form of a question. Any further discussion? Not all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. That concludes action on number 19, and the time is 4:02 p.m. Thank you. And that concludes our agenda for today. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
See ya. Thank you. Well done. Good luck. Thank you. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's from their letter. So, yeah, so I assume.